Good morning and welcome to the FWE Pitch for the Purse Educational Conference Call. I would like to introduce Lisa Nemenche. Please go ahead.
Thank you so much. So good morning, Western Canada, and good afternoon, Eastern Canada, and welcome to the Pitch for the Purse Educational Call featuring Mike Volker. My name is Lisa Nemenchek. I'm the General Manager of the Forum for Women Entrepreneurs and thrilled to welcome almost 100 women entrepreneurs. You are here today because you want to grow, you're risk takers, you want to learn, and you know what? We're here to help. I'm actually dialing in this afternoon from the Canadian Women Entrepreneurs Conference here in Toronto. It's hosted by Minister Bardish Chagger, who's our Speaker of the House and Minister of Small Business. Right beside me in the next room, there's 200 women who are determined more than ever, especially in light of last night, to work together with all women to support your dreams, to empower you and help you move forward. And thank you for your time this morning. I'd like to introduce Christina Anthony, FWE's founder and chair, to say a few words before we begin and introduce our speaker, Mike Volker. Over to you, Christina.
Thank you so much, Lisa. Welcome, everybody, and it's wonderful to have so many people dialing in. FWE is a charitable organization really focused on mentoring and educating women entrepreneurs. For those who don't know us and for those who do, welcome back, and it's wonderful to have you participating in another one of our programs. And with regard to Pitch for the Purse, you know, our main purpose in doing Pitch for the Purse, the Pitch for the Purse program, is to provide education to women entrepreneurs in terms of the kinds of capital that can be accessed, how to access that capital, you know, what is it that investors need to hear to be enticed to want to learn more about your business, no matter what kind of capital it is. And, you know, we really feel that no matter what stage of a business you're at, there's always a need for capital of some kind, or there may be in your near future. And so I think it's great that you've all agreed to dial in to learn more about this. We really encourage you to share what you learned today with other people that you know, because this isn't a topic that's talked about that often, we find, in the marketplace. And we will have a recording of the call, and Lisa will provide all that information further at the end. But the actual details about the recording will be circulated by email, along with a package of other information that can help supplement your learning from this call, and just give further tips and information about, you know, different funding sources that are available and different tips about pitching and, you know, more information about access to capital. But please feel free to share this with anybody you want. You can share the recording. You can share the information, because, again, our mandate is to educate and mentor women entrepreneurs across Canada, and we want you to help, you know, share that absolutely. So please do that. I will now turn it back over to I guess there's one more thing, and that is about the application. So the applications for the Pitch for the Purse program are open until tomorrow evening, and there's a lot more information about that on our website at fwe.ca or pitchforthepurse.com. So please take a look, and you can forward any questions to the team at FWE about the program and more details about the program. But I'm going to turn it back over to Lisa to introduce a dear friend of FWE, Mike Volker. Lisa?
Thank you so much, Christina. Okay, so we're thrilled to have Mike Volker speaking for us today. He's a high-tech entrepreneur and investor who's been involved in technology-based businesses for decades. He's got over 30 years' experience with technology ventures, and he's been doing this since the 70s. And since then, he's been involved in many enterprises as an investor, as a mentor, as a director, and frankly, as a speaker for FWE. His expertise is in financing. It's in marketing, licensing of technology, international property matters, and so on. He's a frequent speaker, contributor to business journals, and so on. He was named Canadian Angel Investor of the Year in 2009 by the National Angel Organization, as well as BC Angel of the Year by the BC Angel Forum. He's a well-known business leader and angel in Vancouver, and we're thrilled to have him speak today. Over to you, Mike. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Lisa, for those kind remarks and introduction, and hello, everyone, and thanks for joining the call. So this is all about pitching, and the question, of course, comes up right away is, who are you pitching to? So as people who are thinking of running a business, starting a business, or those of you who have already done that and are on your way, you would probably be pitching to all kinds of constituents, perhaps customers, your suppliers. And don't forget, suppliers can also be a form of credit for you. Investors, bankers, and employees, especially employees. If you're trying to recruit people to join your team, it's very important that they understand what it is that you're doing. And after last night's election that I think probably most of us stayed up late to watch, it sort of begs the question, who did Trump pitch to? And I would kind of leave that with you all just to think about a little bit, because obviously he knew who he was pitching to, and it turned out to be effective. So the next question would be, how long should you pitch? And this will, of course, depend on the circumstances, whether you're in a competition, a pitch competition, such as the one that Christina was talking about, or maybe it's presenting at an angel forum or event, or maybe it's just at a cocktail party or something like that where you are introduced to investors or potential investors. So you have to tailor your pitch to the time available and, of course, to the audience. And as I mentioned, I'm going to be focusing mainly on pitching to investors. I would suggest that you be able to make your case in 60 seconds, in roughly a minute. Think of it as a TV commercial. It's amazing how much you can get from a television commercial and understand the product and what it is and what it'll do for you. So think of it a little bit that way. If you have more than 60 seconds, then great. You can fill in some details and embellish a little bit. But, you know, it's a bit like a job interview. We all know that when you're being interviewed or when you're interviewing someone else, you usually make your mind up in the first few seconds even as to whether you like the person or not and whether you want to spend more time with them and whether you might employ them. And the same thing is true with pitching to investors. I hear hundreds of pitches, dozens every month, and my mind is usually made up within the first 10 or 15 seconds as to whether this is an opportunity I'd like to learn more about. One mistake that people make is they tend to provide too much information. I kind of call that infobesity, and it's not really a good thing, because I find often the more that someone will say or the more that more time they're given, it allows them really to shoot themselves in the foot, and maybe they say too much and could turn off an investor. So it's important just to make your presentation compelling. That's one of my favorite words. And intriguing, another favorite word. If you can make it compelling and intriguing, the idea is to get a second chance to meet, say, privately with that investor. Think of it a bit like a dating game. You know, you meet somebody kind of casually, and then you say, let's get together and learn a little bit more about each other. And, you know, frankly, you're not likely to score with an investor on the first meeting. So you don't have to tell them everything, just enough to get them enthusiastic enough to want to spend some time with you to learn more about the opportunity. Now, let's talk a little bit about some best practices in terms of making a presentation, especially if you're involved in something like a pitch competition. First thing is to be really cognizant of what investors are looking for. I would suggest that in making your presentation, you keep it to roughly just one or two slides per minute. So if you only have 60 seconds, you just have maybe two slides maximum. If you have 5 minutes, say five slides is a good guideline. Use big font, big letters. Don't put a lot of information on there, because you don't want your audience to read what's on the screen and not listen to you. So, you know, things like diagrams, photographs of your product, and things like that are very useful, photos especially. Avoid using things like video and audio clips at many presentations. They, for some reason, usually don't work. And then it cuts into your time, and it distracts people, and the audience, they start talking to each other and that kind of thing. So try to keep it really simple. The nice thing about using a PowerPoint is that there are images there, and then people will remember, but again, use big fonts. So what should be in that presentation? Let's start with the opportunity. What is the opportunity? What is your opportunity, and what is the opportunity for the investor? Here is where scale is very important. How ambitious are you, and how big do you want your business to become? And that's really, really important, because there are all kinds of investors interested in all kinds of businesses, and it's important for you to connect with those who can relate to you and how ambitious you are and how big you want to make your venture. The first thing you'd want to start off, and you get this right at the beginning, is what is it that you're selling? And try to be very specific in that. You know, if it's a device, a product, a service, describe that simply and succinctly. And why is it better than what's out there now? Why are people going to just rush out and buy this? This is where, especially if there's technology involved, we often hear the word intellectual property. Investors like to hear that. But intellectual property doesn't just mean patents. It could be your secret sauce, your trade secret, your know-how. What is it that is embodied in your product that gives you an advantage? As an example, one of the companies here in Vancouver that I invested in was a vegan cheese product. And you might think, well, that doesn't sound like much tech. But it is, because of the secret formulation and the secret recipe that made for a very excellent vegan cheese product. So that's the IP, and that's what I think attracted investors to that particular company. So it's good to mention that. If you have time, again, it's one of those things where if you only have 60 seconds, you don't want to talk a lot about that, but still focus on the product and what makes it better or different. And even if people right now aren't using something like that, there must be something else that they're doing to address the problem that you're solving. So you always want to compare what you're offering to something that either exists or something that your potential customers are already doing or using presently. Then the next thing to emphasize is how you're going to make money. You know, what's your business case? You know, what are your margins, for example? What is your sales projection? How big is are you going to be in, say, 5 years out? Are you going to be a $10 million venture, or is it going to be a $50 million venture? Top line, and what's your bottom line? How much profit are you going to make on those top line revenues? Then that's great for you to know, and it's great for the investor to know, but the next thing that especially the investor wants to know is how is she or he going to make money? So they might invest in your deal, but ultimately they need to get something out of it, and it's very important to understand that. How are they going to participate with you in this fantastic opportunity that you're laying out for them? Are you going to sell them shares? Are they going to make you a loan and provide you some form of debt? Are you going to do some form of royalty deal where you advance them, where the investor advances you some cash, and then you pay them back out of your sales, maybe a 4 or 5% monthly charge on your revenues? There's all kinds of creative ways to do this and to structure a deal. Again, you don't have time usually in an initial pitch to go into too much detail, but you should certainly know this for follow-on presentations. And in case there's a Q&A, and one of the questions that angel investors especially always ask at pitch sessions is, how am I going to make money? What's my exit opportunity? How long do I have to wait as an investor to cash in? And if you're thinking of selling the business to someone, who might that be? And how much might they pay for it? So these are the kinds of things you want to be thinking about, especially when you're talking to, say, angel investors. And I'll talk a little bit more about angel investors in a few minutes. I want to talk a little bit now about what can kill a pitch. What would be, say, a bad pitch or one that turns off investors? It's very important, I think, to avoid a lot of fluff and, for lack of a better word, BS. Or hyperbole might be a more civilized term to use. Say something, avoid things like, for example, we are a world-class provider of HR enterprise solutions. We provide a SaaS product that helps companies manage their HR recruiting process. I don't know what that means. It's just a bunch of words. I don't understand what the specific product is. I don't understand what the pain is that the customer is experiencing that's going to be addressed. It's just fluff. So try to be very succinct in describing what you're doing. Avoid too many adjectives and fluffy words. Try to be kind of humble and down to earth in terms of what it is you're doing. Very important to avoid the so-called billion-dollar market mention. Many entrepreneurs that I hear, they start off by saying, "Well, you know, we're in the food industry, and that's a global, multi-billion-dollar industry, and that's where we are, and that's where the opportunity is." That turns investors off because it shows that you don't know what your niche is, where you are going to compete against others. So it's important that you dominate your particular niche and be as focused as you can on the customers that you're pursuing. And if you can say that you're going after a $100 million market and you're going to dominate that market, that really resonates with investors. But if you say something like, we're going after this global $20 billion market and we're going to get just, 1% of that, that's a big turnoff because investors are thinking, well, how are they even going to get 1%? And what does that mean? So avoid that that kind of thing where you say, 1% of a huge market. Investors would rather hear that you're going to get 60% of a much smaller, more narrowly defined market. The other thing that, of course, can kill a pitch, especially to investors, and I kind of briefly touched on this moments ago, was, not understanding how investors are going to make money. Keep in mind that it's very, very easy for people to write a check and get involved with your business, but you have to be also thinking about how are they going to get a check back and make some money on their investment. Another area that I often see entrepreneurs missing is competition. It's very, it's a big turnoff to not know and understand who's competing with you. Many times I'll be sitting in an audience listening to a presentation and then I'll start Googling certain words that the presenter says, especially around the product, because one minute I hear them say, well, we don't have a lot of competition. Then I type in words into the Google search window and up come immediately all kinds of things that at least look like they could be competitive. So it's important to do your research, and I would go so far as to say if you can't find direct competitors, make some up. I mean, that may sound a little bit strange, but there you can rest assured there is always going to be somebody somewhere working on something very similar to what you're trying to do. It just amazes me. I travel around to angel groups throughout North America and even globally. I've heard pitches in India, Australia, China, and it's what always amuses me is I'll hear a pitch one day in one city, and then I'll hear pitches another day in a different city. And it's amazing how the products and the opportunities sound very similar. So, if you think you've got a really good idea and you're unique, there's probably somebody else, maybe somewhere in Poughkeepsie, Illinois, or wherever, working away in their garage or basement with something very, very similar. So competitive knowledge is very important, and if you don't show some command of of that, of understanding who your competition is, that again can be a big turnoff. So in terms of what might, and just a couple of other quick things, I would say if you come across like, for lack of a better word, a bit of a know-it-all, that can also turn off investors. It's always good to show that, you know, you're open to learning, that you're open to suggestions. If you come across too sort of set, and it's a fine balance between being confident and going overboard on that. And I think a little hubris, you know, can certainly kill a deal if it's not handled properly. Now, on the positive side, let's just spend a couple of minutes on what impresses an investor. I mentioned earlier the words compelling and intriguing. In the compelling category, I think if you can show how passionate you are about your opportunity, how committed you are to it, and the confidence that you have in making it a success, that is very, very high in the sort of ranking in a potential investor's mind. It's very, very important that you come across as being absolutely engaged and absolutely committed to this venture. The way that you speak and the way that you explain yourself is very important. Your expressions, your eye contact, the way that you explain the opportunity. I heard a presentation by a scientist who does not have a lot of business experience, and he was so passionate about his research that he was able to get investors just on the strength of that, without actually spending too much time on the numbers and the details of the business. He was able to get a large audience with investors just because he was personally so excited about this opportunity. And if you're really excited, then that enthusiasm can kind of pervade others, and if they feel that, they'll not want to miss out on your opportunity. Having some deep domain knowledge is equally important. Really understanding the industry that you're working in, understanding your customers, understanding your suppliers, and very importantly, understanding the risks. And it's a good idea. Investors like to see this, for you to point out, you know, what can go wrong, who can eat your lunch, who can blindside you. Are there any economic considerations that might create problems? Are there any trade barriers, for that matter, that could create issues? Currency fluctuations? Are any of these things risks that you should be aware of and perhaps mention to investors? What it does is it gives investors the confidence that you know what you're doing. Of course, I already talked enough about competitive knowledge. I think now's a good time for me to shift gears a little bit and talk specifically about angel investing, which is sort of my passion and where I spend a lot of my time running a number of angel networks where entrepreneurs come and pitch. And of course, all of you on this call are invited to these venues, and I'd be happy to give you details on how you can learn about them. And at these venues, you have an opportunity to present to numerous angel investors. Maybe it's only 10 or 20, or maybe it's 50 or 100, but there are many, many venues where you can do this. And these exist across Canada. For that matter, they're now global. You can go to almost every decent-sized city, and there'll be an angel group or organization or even informal angel investors that are receptive to listening to presentations. And I would say in Canada, angel investors, and by the way, let me just define angel investor. An angel investor is typically a successful entrepreneur. You know, fast forward, somebody like you ladies on the phone call, someone who's built a business, done well with that business, ending up with cash and experience, and now keen to put some of that cash and experience back into helping someone else go through that whole entrepreneurial experience. So that's typically what an angel investor is. And the other thing about angel investors is they invest their own capital. Unlike institutional investors, we often hear about venture capitalists. Venture capitalists manage somebody else's money, typically pension funds, institutional money, or money that's given to them by high net worth individuals to manage and get a good return. So venture capitalists invest on behalf of other people using other people's money. As a result, they have to be a lot more careful about what they invest in. They can't go by gut feeling, for example. Whereas angel investors, if an angel likes you, that's number one. Because as I mentioned earlier, it's a bit of a dating game. It's a partnership that you're entering into with an angel investor. And you want to make sure that there's that personal harmony or synergy. And an angel will also invest quickly. They'll make up their mind maybe at the first meeting, as I mentioned, like a job interview. They may decide very early on that they like you and are going to invest. So the process with angels could take days or weeks, whereas with venture capitalists and institutional investors, it typically takes months. You often hear 6 to 9 months mentioned. The other thing is that angels will invest, relative to others, smaller amounts. In Canada, that range is $100,000 to $1 million. The average in Canada is about $600,000 per company. So a group of investors, typically anywhere from 5 to 12 or so, will together invest $600,000 in your company. Venture capitalists, on the other hand, are looking for opportunities where they can put in at least $2 million and see their way to an exit where you sell your company for a value that's in excess of $100 million. So obviously, if you can't make the case that you're going to be a $100 million company in a short period of time, say 5 to 10 years, you probably shouldn't be talking to venture capitalists. And I would go so far as to say that even if you're thinking of talking to venture capitalists and you have a really big opportunity that can attract venture capitalists, it still makes sense to talk to angel investors because they can help you get started with some seed money, what we call seed capital. That's typically sort of first round of equity capital that goes into a company. So they can get you started with that. They can also provide you with some mentoring and advice and probably even connections with larger, more serious, deep-pocketed investors like venture capitalists. The other thing I would mention about angels is the sort of legal definition for an angel investor is what is referred to as an accredited investor. And that's a very important word. Accredited does not mean that the investor has passed some kind of test that involves their knowledge. But it is a test, and it's a financial worth test. So the British Columbia Securities Commission, for example, which is a FWE sponsor, defines accredited investor as someone who makes at least $200,000 a year or has a net worth, not counting house, because in Vancouver, for example, everyone could be accredited. So not counting your residence, but counting liquid assets, stocks, bonds, that kind of thing, of more than $1 million. So if you meet one of those two tests, you're an accredited investor. So what does that mean in Canada? In Canada, that means that less than 5% of the entire population is accredited. In fact, in a recent Stats Can report, I observed that the cutoff to be in the top 1% of income earners in Canada was at $201,000, which coincidentally is just $1,000 above the definition of $200,000. So that's only 1% of Canadian tax filers that are in that group. Of course, when you add in those that are reporting less than $200,000 but have $1 million to invest, then that increases that percentage to about 5%. So don't get discouraged. You know, that sounds like a relatively small number. On the other hand, the securities regulators, like the BCSC, are opening the doors a little bit to help entrepreneurs. And they're doing that by what's called, for example, a crowdfunding exemption. And you might have heard about crowdfunding, things like Kickstarter, where you can go and raise capital by, or actually you're not really raising capital, you're really generating revenue by letting people buy into your product. But there is now crowdfunding, and there are a couple of sites and organizations in different parts of Canada where you can go and offer your shares or equity in your company to people who are not technically accredited. So that kind of opens the door to the whole population. The only catch there, and it's something I should warn you about, is that investors are typically limited to how much they can put in. So it might only be a few thousand dollars as opposed to $50,000 or $100,000, which is something that accredited investors can do. It's very, very important for you as entrepreneurs to not go afoul of the law or afoul of the regulations. I'm always surprised at how many entrepreneurs don't understand that they cannot just simply sell shares to anyone. You have to make sure that you comply with these securities regulations. And a good way to learn about that is just by going to, for example, the BCSC website. They'll tell you how you can raise money and what the rules are. Talk to a lawyer, talk to a mentor in the program, especially someone with a legal background. And they can fill you in on all these little rules and details. And I just mention that here so that you don't lose sight of that. I mean, we could spend another half an hour talking about it, but I don't want to bore you all to death with rules and regulations. So enough said on that. Let's go back to angel investing. At what stage should you be talking to angels and introducing yourself and your company to angels? I would suggest you start sooner than later. As soon as, even if you have an idea, it's sometimes good to throw that out to get a reaction from investors. Is it investable? Is it something that might resonate with investors? At some of the angel meetings that I'm involved with, we have short pitch sessions where entrepreneurs, researchers, students, others can stand up and say, here's my idea, here's what I'm thinking about doing. And they can get some instant feedback on that, which is perhaps very valuable. But again, the sooner the better, because you're trying to build, you're trying to connect with angels and build a relationship. And the sooner you start that process, the sooner you're going to be able to attract serious capital. And what's involved? Well, first of all, it's the pitch. You want to get their attention and interest. And then following that, you're going to have to make your business case. And the business case is very important. If you're interested, on my website, and I'll give you some links at the end of the presentation, on my website there's a short little book that you can download. I think it's a free download called Making the Business Case. And it just kind of outlines what's really important to communicate to investors. It's kind of like a business plan, but perhaps a little bit more more basic than a full-blown business plan. How do you find an angel investor? I mentioned that they're all over the country. If you, for example, go to the NACO Canada website, you can get information, very specific information, you know, where are they, who runs them, how do you apply, and so on. That website is NACOCanada.com, N-A-C-O, for National Angel Capital Organization, NACOCanada.com. And they can point you to angel groups wherever you happen to be located. Now let's talk a little bit about, and one other thing I would suggest in making contact with individual angels is referrals are really good. If you can just make contact with maybe other entrepreneurs that you know that have been supported by angels, if they can introduce you to someone that's helped them. An introduction is really, really good, and it's probably more effective than just broadcasting your message. Let's talk about what angel investors look for. So like other investors, they're looking for a compelling proposition, a solid business case. They want to know how you're going to make money and how they're going to make money. Their expectation is a very high return. Angel investors are not looking for a 5 or 10% return on their investment. They want to make hundreds of percent return. In fact, you know, a good rule of thumb is convince an angel that they can make 10 times their money in less than 10 years. If, in fact, they make 10 times their money in 10 years, that happens to work out to an IRR, internal rate of return, of 26%. On the other hand, if they can make even 5 times their money in 5 years, that's 38% internal rate of return. You should understand those numbers, and you should understand that that's the range that investors, angel investors specifically, are working in. That's their expectation. They want to see how they're going to make that kind of multiple on their money. And why is that? That's because they can invest in relatively secure financial instruments that are available to private investors that give them 15%. So by taking a high risk on your company, you've got to show them how they're going to make well over 15% over time. And if you can't do that, you're going to be wasting your time. I had someone approach me not long ago, and they were looking at angel investors kind of like banks and thinking that, you know, a 5 or 6% return is what angels would like to see. Not so. Absolutely false. They want to see some pretty decent return. Unless, of course, and here's an exception, you know, sometimes you'll find an angel investor who just wants to help you, and maybe they will give you something in the form of a loan at a very low rate. But it's not common. It's not something I see very often. The other thing that angels look for, and it's a personal characteristic, they want an entrepreneur that's coachable, someone that's going to listen to their suggestions, not necessarily follow all the suggestions, but at least be open and receptive and coachable, and also understand what they don't know. You know, in business, no one knows everything, unless maybe Donald Trump, but other than him, you know, nobody has a monopoly on business knowledge. So if you're open to ideas and suggestions and willing to learn, that's something that angel investors really appreciate in the entrepreneur that they're investing. It's important that you understand the sort of investing landscape, and the fact that for angels is that it's very, very tough to make money as an investor. These angels know that 80% of startups fail in the first 5 years. And if you think that's bad, 80% of those that are left typically fail in the next 5 years. So that means within a 10-year period, you've got maybe 4 or 5 out of 100 companies that make it. Angel investors know that, and that's another reason why they need those high returns, because what they're going to do is invest in 20 companies with the expectation that each one is going to give them 10 times their money back. But they know that only a very small percentage is actually going to do that. And if that happens, then overall, they're going to be making money, and that keeps them in the business and keeps them interested as active angel investors. So, having said all of that, I think it's probably time to open up for some Q&A. I'll just quickly mention some websites. You know, if you're on your laptops or desktops, you might want to open some of these up. If you go to my own website, mikevolker.com, you'll see links there to some of the angel groups that I'm involved with. You'll also see the little booklet that I referred to on making the business case. Another link that you'll see there is vantech.ca. That's for those of you out west in the Vancouver area. That's our monthly angel group. Another link is New Ventures BC. That's a business competition that we run here in British Columbia. I point you to that even if you're, you know, in Toronto or Quebec. You might find that interesting because there's some good resource material there. There's also the NACO Canada website that I mentioned earlier that has information. They also have resource materials. They will help you look at things like term sheets. And just speaking about term sheets, the one thing that I didn't mention that you have to also be thinking hard about is, what's your company worth? What are you valuing it at? So if you're trying to sell shares in your company to an investor or a group of investors, let's say you're going for that $500,000 seed round, what are you going to give those investors for that $500,000? Is it going to be 20% of your company, or is it going to be 40%, or is it going to be like Dragons on the Dragon's Den where they want over 50%? You have to be thinking about what your business is worth. That's a very interesting area. Something we can talk a lot about, but unfortunately is a little bit beyond the scope of this particular seminar.
Actually, so, Mike, it's Lisa here, and maybe before we go into Q&A, we do still have some time before questions. Could you actually dive a little bit into the valuation? Because for those participants who are fully involved in the pitch for the purse, and in particular the 10, there's some 10 people on this call who will be a semifinalist and actually pitching on November the 25th, where do you start in terms of valuing your business? You know, you might need $100,000. But you don't know, okay, gosh, does that equal, is that 50% of my company or is that 10%? And what, how do you actually create that valuation for the company? You know, is it based on sales or projected sales? And I guess what kind of metrics would someone use? If you could provide some insight into that, that'd be great.
Okay, that's I'm happy to do that. It's actually simpler than many people think it is, and it's driven by market dynamics. It's kind of like real estate. You know, a house in Vancouver might be worth more than one than exactly the same house in Saskatoon. So it's a market-driven thing. And by that, what I mean is you look at other angel deals, comparables, you know, like real estate, houses that have sold nearby in your community. That helps you figure out what your house is worth. So in angel investing, you look at what kinds of deals have angels done and what are the valuations of those. So, for example, NACO Canada that I refer to on the website, you'll see reports on valuations of companies, and that gives you a range. And so you, first of all, have to be in that range. Regardless of what you think the company is worth, the fact is that angel investors in Canada are valuing companies somewhere in the $2 to $3 million range when they're a startup. It doesn't seem to matter how big they may ultimately become, and it doesn't seem to matter a lot what their business numbers are looking like, but it always seems to come down to something in that $2 to $3 million range. So if you're raising, $500,000, you're going to be giving up roughly 20 to 30% of your company to do that. Another market comparable is, and this is kind of an interesting one, typically you're going to be, regardless of how much you're looking for, whether it's $100,000, $500,000, or $1 million, you're going to be giving up roughly a third of the company. Maybe not as much as a third, but let's say close to a third, 20 to 30% is the range that we see here in Canada. So you're going to give up, if you're only looking for $100,000, you're still going to give up, say, 20%. And the reason for that, and it's a very simple explanation, it's like dividing the pie. You're bringing someone in as a partner. You've got the ideas. You've got the energy. Your partner's bringing in the capital. Without that capital, you're not going to go anywhere. unless you, you know, really work hard and bootstrap it and talk everybody into working for free, if you think you need capital and your business is not going to work without that capital, then, you know, investors look at startups and say, well, they're worth zero, because without money, that's exactly what they are worth. So if I'm putting in the money, I want a decent share of that pie, and that share has got to be meaningful, and it's got to be somewhere in the 20 to 30% range. Now, the exception to that will be television shows like Dragon's Den, where, and I would encourage you not to put a lot of, don't rely on those as benchmarks, because they're kind of quite a bit different from what we actually see in the real angel investing community. So that's sort of the number one thing about valuations. You can do, you know, cash flow projections and discount them to a present value and do all those kinds of fancy accounting things, but frankly, 99% of the angel investors that I know don't look at those numbers, because everybody knows that numbers are just projections and they may or may not happen. So it comes down to putting the team together, and part of that team is the investing group. And for them to be engaged and interested, you've got to deal them in to the tune of roughly a third of the business.
Thank you, Mike. And I guess so then a company then that might have already, say, revenues of $5 million, if they're asking for, say, $3 million, just pulled a random number, then I guess you would apply that same formula. So, you know, three representing, say, 30%, so then you might value the company then at $9 million. Would that be kind of roughly the formula, the thinking you would use?
Yes, exactly. And, you know, typically growing companies will raise capital at different times. So you've got you might have an initial round, which is just the entrepreneur's own money, maybe family money, friends, relatives, maybe a couple $100,000 to get things moving. And then you go to angels and do a so-called seed round, which is, as I mentioned, roughly in the 500 to a million range. And for that, you'll give up, say, 30% of the company. Then a year or two later, you might now be up at $3 or $4 or $5 million a year run rate, annual revenues, and maybe at that point you're looking for $1 or $2 million to get you to double your revenue. Again, at that point, you're going to be giving up roughly a third. And then let's say you're really on a roll, and now you're doing $20 or $30 million in revenue, and you need to raise $10 million to get you to 100. Again, you're probably going to be giving up roughly a third of the equity at that stage. And it's always a third of what, you know, a third dilution at each stage. So it's not like you're starting with, you know, if you work through the arithmetic, it's not like you're giving up three times a third and losing the whole company. It's always just diluting by a third at each stage, if you get my drift.
Great, thank you. All right, I'll have some comments after Q&A, but maybe let's open it up to a few minutes of Q&A. Cheryl, if you'd like to introduce the first question, please.
Certainly. To queue up for the question period, hit 01 on your handset now. If you change your mind and wish to withdraw your question, hit the pound key on your handset. So we have our first questioner, and that's Dion Baker from DD's Organics. Please go ahead.
Hi, thanks for the information. That was a very interesting webinar, and I think we learned a lot about presenting to investors. I'm interested to know, because we're in, I guess, maybe just a little bit different position where we already have some investors where we've launched our food company across Canada, and next year should be on virtually every shelf, every retailer within Canada except Costco and Walmart, and then parts going to parts of the U.S. So our valuation wouldn't correspond necessarily to what you were talking about, and the investors have come in early on at about a $4 to $4.5 million valuation. So how does that look from an angel investor when our revenues are somewhere around the $1 million mark right now, but next year we've already got contracts from Loblaws and Safeway and Sobeys and HEB in the States and Whole Foods. How does that look? Because it's a different kind of perspective in terms of the current investors and how they came in. So how does that look from your perspective?
Are you saying that the money you've already raised from your previous investors was based on a 4 to 4.5 million valuation?
Yes, yeah.
Well, congratulations, you did very well.
Thanks.
you would be what I would call an outlier. You would be, at the far right of that scale. And if you've been able to do that, it's probably because you've really been able to communicate very effectively what you're doing. I also heard you talk about your distribution and your revenue. And the other thing that's very important to investors, especially angel investors, if you can show that you've already got customers and traction and a clear path to substantial revenues, that will put your valuation at the high end. You know, keep in mind, most angel deals are pre-revenue, where companies are not yet generating revenue or where they don't have customers. But if you've got customers and revenue, then you can command a much higher valuation. And investors will go along with that. There are those investors who, even if they go with, say, a 4 to 5 million valuation, may want some protection, and they will do that through the term sheet that they negotiate with you. So, for example, they may put in a clause which says that at the time you sell the company, they would at least get their money back, and they would do that if they think the valuation is a little bit on the high side. I've done some deals where I've gone with a higher valuation, let's say your range, $4 million, but let's say the company only exits at a $5 million valuation. And because you've got things like stock options and other factors, plus perhaps second and third financing rounds, there have been many cases where angel investors might not even get their money back. So if they go with a high valuation, they may want to make sure that if you don't hit a home run but have a marginal outcome, they'll at least have some degree of protection. I mention that because if that's part of the package, it would make an investor more amenable to accepting a valuation at the higher end of the scale.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's very good advice. Thank you.
Does that help?
That does help. That does help, and I'll look into that term sheet a little bit further. Was that like a personal guarantee, or just like a more of a financial guarantee in the term sheet?
You could do it through a shareholders agreement, but the most common way of doing it, and this is where there's a bit of a difference between, say, the United States and Canada, but I'm seeing it happen more and more frequently now, even in Canada. And that's where the investors may come in with something like either a convertible note or perhaps a preferred share. So if they take a preferred share that's convertible to common, then if there's a liquidity event, the preferred shareholders would get paid out before the common shareholders.
Okay. And then to future investors, is that a negative? Would that be a deterrent to like a private equity firm? If you have preferred shares?
No, I think it would be an attraction, not an
insurance. Okay,
yeah, I think
okay,
it would
okay,
attract
good.
Investors. You know, it means a little bit of additional legal work because you've got to create a separate class of shares, but it gives investors a bit more protection. And, of course, the preferred shares can be converted to common so that if you do hit it out of the park, then they would participate as common shareholders. But if you have a not so great outcome, they have a shot at least recovering their capital.
Mm-hmm, that makes
especially,
sense.
You know, especially if they have a small percentage. So if they only have, say, 20% of your company, then let's say you and the founding team have the other 80%, and you have that as founder shares that you only paid, you know, pennies for, then you'd be getting a big chunk of that payout. And it may be such that it's at the expense of the investors. So if they have a preferential position, then at least they won't agonize as much about a higher valuation because they know that they've got some protection on a sloppy exit.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Do we have another question?
Yes, and before we take the next questioner, a quick reminder, press 01 on your handset anytime to queue up for a question. Our next question is from Trish Mandiwo, Vancouver Tumblebus. Please go ahead, Trish.
Hi there. So, my name is Trish, and I am with Vancouver Tumblebus, which is a mobile gym for kids. And my question is that, is there a magic number that you would say will be more appealing to angel investors? You know, for example, you know, if you're a small business and you're still under the $500,000 mark and you're pitching to angel investors, would they look at you, or do you think maybe when you hit the $1 million mark, then you're more attractive and that you have better chances?
Good question. So one thing you should know is that angel investors are not a homogeneous group. They're not like bankers, and they're not like venture capitalists. They're individual people, and each individual person has a different appetite and criteria for investment. So I know angel investors that like to look at really early opportunities that may only need $200,000. I know other investors who don't want to come in that early. They want to wait until you need at least $500,000 or $1 million. So the beauty of angel investing is that there's such a variety of angel investors. And when you're making your presentation, it's important that you explain what it is that you're looking for so that you connect with the investors that have an appetite in that range that you're looking for. And then it's a matter of sitting down with them and talking about how you're going to, what they're going to get for that, and how ultimately they're going to make money on that. And if, for example, you've got a business which is going to grow to a, let's say, steady, stable $5 or $10 million a year type of business, then you might be thinking about paying them back from sales, maybe a percentage on sales. Because you don't want the investors to be in there forever, unless, of course, you're paying them dividends forever. But, you know, generally investors will cash in when you sell the business or merge with another company. So that's all part of the discussion you will have. But, you know, don't worry about if you think that all you need is $100,000 or $200,000. Rest assured, there are many investors out there that would be more than happy to talk with you about an opportunity like that.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. That helps.
Great. And we have time for one more quick question, and then I'll have some closing remarks.
Excellent. So our last questioner is Stacy Irving, Thompson Life Science. Please go ahead.
Hi, thanks, Michael. That was a great presentation. I learned a ton. I have one, I guess I'll go as quick as I can. So my company has revenues of about $5 million. We did have one angel investor initially at about $1 million who we have paid back, so he did it more as a loan. Now, it's a healthcare and fitness company, and the people running it are all health and fitness people, which means we have very little business experience. If we were looking for an angel investor, I think it would be very helpful for us to have someone with way more business experience that would help us. How do you find that person?
Yes. One of the, you know, I mentioned in my remarks earlier that angel investors often make good mentors and
right.
like to get involved with the business. But again, there's a wide variety of angels. I know individuals who they just don't have the time to do a lot of mentoring. They just like what you're doing. Sometimes they may invest because their friends are investing and they rely on their friends to make the investment decision. But when you're making your pitch to a group, it's important to mention that you're looking for people with business expertise, and I'm hearing more and more entrepreneurs do that, where they say, okay, we're looking for 1 million or 2 million or whatever, but we're also looking for people that can join us, perhaps as directors. And angels actually make good board members because they've got some governance experience, they've got some business experience, and as board members, they can provide that oversight. So there's really two sort of categories where you can put angels to help you on the business side. You can put them on as directors, and personally I think, and I'll only invest as an angel in a company that has a board of directors comprised entirely of external people, people that are outside of the company other than the CEO. So for a startup, the CEO plus two, let's say, angels as directors, or maybe the CEO plus four for a total of five, so either three or five directors with the majority being independent would make a good board. And angels are excellent candidates to fill that.
Then the other
category is there are those who really don't want the responsibility of being directors, but they would rather work a day or two a week really inside the company. So instead of kind of working on the company, providing that oversight to you as the CEO, they'd be almost more like consultants, except you don't have to pay them as you would consultants. You might give them stock options or shares or something like that. And then they would help you, especially if they have expertise in certain areas. They might have, you know, supply chain know-how. They might may have financial expertise. They may be able to connect you with other investors. But it's important for you in your pitch to include that. And then the same way that you'll find investors opening up their wallets, you'll find investors opening up their brains or their expertise to guide you along. So you again have to mention that in your presentations.
Okay, thank you very much. That's very helpful.
Wonderful. Okay. Thank you, Stacey. Great question. And a huge thank you, Mike. Very much appreciate the time spent this morning. Before we close up, a few points. So first of all, the educational materials and the recording from this call are going to be sent out by email from Michelle. Thank you, Michelle, tomorrow. So please keep your eyes out for that and please share it with other entrepreneurs. If you haven't applied to take part in the entire pitch program, but now you're compelled to, the deadline to apply for the full Pitch for the Purse program is tomorrow, and it involves the SurveyMonkey application as well as submitting a really quick 30-second video of yourself. This does not need to be super fancy with special lighting or audio. You can just honestly take your iPhone and just introduce yourself on the video. There's a couple details of what's involved in the actual application. For those of you who are thinking about being a full participant and who have already applied to be a full participant, and there's many of you across the country, the semi-finalists will be announced on November the 15th. That's on Tuesday. And there's going to be 10 semi-finalists, and they're all invited to Vancouver to present their pitch on November the 25th at the Pitch Breakfast. And really, you're going to be pitching for whatever money you need for your business. It could be $100,000 for 10% of your company. It could be $1 million for 50% of a $2 million company, for example. As Mike mentioned, you should keep your PowerPoint presentation slides to, you know, approximately 5 to 6 slides. And your entire presentation should be 5 minutes long. And we are going to be timing you. So really 5 minutes. We're going to have 3 mentors on site, judge mentors, who are going to be offering around 8 minutes of helpful discussion and feedback. And they're also going to be asking you some questions about your pitch. And this is all meant to be, you know, interactive and helpful for you. And it's part of, you know, really the educational process. As well, on the 25th, there's going to be around 150 of the FWE community there to watch the pitches and support you and cheer you on. And, of course, our three judge mentors, who include Tracy McVicker of CAI Capital Partners, Dave Bustos of Fort Capital, and Wayne Deans of Deans Knight. And all three will be there, again, providing feedback. As well, they are going to be then paired with the three finalists who are going to be announced at the end of the November 25th breakfast. And they're going to meet with one of the three finalists over around a two-month period to really get them ready and to perfect their pitch and really work on that. And then, of course, the finale of Pitch for the Purse is our gala on February the 20th at the Hotel Vancouver over here. And the audience of the gala is going to be actually voting for the best pitch and will award the $25,000 cash prize. And, of course, it's important to note that this cash prize has no strings attached. It is not an investment. It is simply a prize. And, of course, those of you who are calling and applying from outside Vancouver, you can participate in the semifinals at the breakfast on the 25th via Skype. So we've got that set up. And as well, FWE, we will do our best to find and provide grants for travel to make it possible for you to come out to Vancouver for the semis as well as for the gala, for example. And of course, you know, our 10 semifinalists are going to have a lot of exposure in the broad business community via social media and so on as we, you know, really showcase what amazing companies the 10 semifinalists are and, of course, our three finalists in advance of the gala. Again, thank you, everyone, for joining this call. Thank you, Mike. You're a tireless, long-serving supporter of FWE. We so appreciate this. And again, everyone else, we only were able to take three questions from the audience this morning. If you do have additional questions, please email them to michelle@fwe.ca. Ideally, today would be great. That way we can combine all the questions together, and there may be some similar ones, and then we can get some answers from Mike and Christina, for example, and then shoot the answers out to everyone so we can all learn from one another's questions as well. Okay, it's 2:16 Toronto time, which means it's 11:16 out on the West Coast, so it's time to end this call. Thank you again. If anyone has any questions whatsoever about Pitch for the Purse, please reach out again to michelle@fwe.ca, and you can call her at 604-682-8115. Stay tuned to the recording and to presentation or to some more educational materials tomorrow in your inbox. Thank you all so much. Have a wonderful day.
This concludes the FWE Pitch for the Purse Educational Conference Call. Thank you for your participation and have a nice day.